In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. As we've all witnessed in recent years, the discovery of vaccines can not only save lives, but change the course of human history. And popular historian Simon Sharma's new book sets out to place the story of vaccination into its wider context, charting the individuals and organisations who played a pivotal role in the development of inoculation against diseases including plague, smallpox and cholera. Matt Elton spoke to Simon to find out more.
Simon, you write in your new book that you are acutely conscious that you're a newcomer to medical and scientific history. I wondered what it was that appealed to you or drew you to write this subject.
Well, I guess two things. I mean, obviously, it won't surprise anybody that the pandemic played a large part of it. And originally, I was writing a completely different book, as my publishers were hoping to get a book about nationalism, about the culture of nationalism, about its music and landscape. And that might indeed be a book I may well go back to. When the pandemic happened, I thought, okay, still focused on the original writing agenda, I thought there's one moment historically, really, where nationalism has got to be set aside for the common good. People got to share vaccines. I mean, that's how naive I really was. It's this. And it was quickly disabused by nations leapfrogging over each other to get advanced supplies of whatever vaccines might be developed. And I thought, well, this is sort of a disappointing moment, really. But it led me to material on the founding of the World Health Organization in 1948. So I was getting kind of closer and closer to a kind of history of medicine story, really. And the archive, very good online website of the WHO, pointed me to something I just never heard of before, which were the International Sanitary Conferences of the 19th century. And I thought, whoa, you know, that is extraordinarily interesting because this is the first international organization other than ones responsible for making military alliances or peace conferences. My wife happens to be a biologist. And so I said to her, will I perish with a terminal case of imposter syndrome? She said, no, absolutely not. She shares Science magazine with me. We talk about scientific. So I didn't feel a completely helpless greenhorn, but she really encouraged me to go for this. And there's something about when you're really, really a really old geezer, I think you either escape completely, you either want to do Byzantine coinage in the 11th century. You just want to do your kind of passionate hobby. Or if you're like me, you know, who I spend some of my time being a journalist for the FT, you really only want to do history that has an immediate connection with what's happening right now. So I sailed forth with a lot of trepidation.
It's interesting you mentioned nationalism and your hopes that sort of nationalism might abate a bit in the face of this. How important is the idea of interconnectedness to your telling of this story, I suppose?
Oh, it's absolutely, it's really crucial. You know, I mean, at the end, I say, I suppose, it was my usual choice of understatement. You know, when something like this happens, there are no foreigners, there are only familiars. We are all absolutely connected. And that does seem very a bit utopian, a bit pie in the sky. I understand that. But Ghebreyesus, the head of the WHO, made a comment very early on when we were all terrified and just after vaccines had been announced. He said, well, until everybody is vaccinated, nobody is safe. That's, of course, a massive exaggeration, and we all sorts of things we didn't know about different kinds of vaccines then. But the point about sort of being at a time when travel is so seamless and so immediate, and with all the masks in the world, there's just no barriers and no frontiers, you know. So we have to think globally. We have to really work together, raw, you know, be in a terrible predicament together. So it's absolutely central to it. So, of course, it did converge with a long interest of mine about the perils of excessive national defensiveness. But it seemed to me true to the particular situation.
And the way in which ideas are shared is something we'll get into in a minute. Before we do, I just wanted to say that to me, what surprised me was your book features sort of case studies, kind of short followings of certain people, and a lot of them were completely unknown to me. And I don't know if that's my particular ignorance or whether there's something to be said about the fact these people who played such a pivotal role in this story are now largely unknown. Do you think there is something to say about that?
Yes, I suppose, again, it's presumptuous of me to say, you know, that there have been gaps in the history of medicine, but because it's a fantastically rich literature. I thought a lot. I mentioned this briefly in the acknowledgements, but an old friend now, who died much too young, Roy Porter, we were undergraduates together at Cambridge in the 1960s, and he chose to do history of medicine. He did it really, really brilliantly. He wrote an extraordinary synoptic book called The Greatest Benefit to Mankind. If there's someone I would have also have gone to say, am I crazy to attempt this? It would have been him. So I don't want to say anything about how particular individuals get lost. And they don't all get lost. I mean, the story of Mary Wortley Montagu in Turkey is quite well known, and you probably knew it as well, vaccinating her son and then her daughter and converting Princess, later Queen Caroline. That's quite well known. The person who's not known in that section of the book, I think he's the subject of kind of drive-by attention, is this figure called Angelo Gatti. And I think part of the problem, there is a huge amount of printed literature, startling, an extraordinary amount of printed literature at the time by physicians and surgeons and inoculators and anti-inoculators. But they all have kind of the same titles, actually. Very similar, you know, there are the against titles, the diabolical perils of inoculation or the blessed benefits. So you just really have to read the whole, all of them. You have to read them. And it was only when Gatti was always, because he called himself, ironically, a petite célébrité, he became a kind of inoculator to the fashionable in Paris in the reign of Louis XV. In the middle of the 18th century. He then just has been adopted by people in the literature of inoculation as a celebrity vaccinator, a celebrity inoculator. So he's rather kind of trivial person. But if you actually read those two little books of his, I was sort of just blown away by how radical and extraordinary they were, because he said all this business about an elaborate diet and 2 weeks of preparation before anybody can be inoculated is completely pointless, everybody. So I thought that was just astonishing. So there is something about the sheer density of the literature in which people who seem to be just another add-on to the literature do get lost. And I think it's dumb luck on my part that, you know, I just sort of stubbed my toe on one or two of these and after saying, ow, saw how incredibly important they were.
I just wanted to talk a little bit for people who might not know about smallpox, which is the sort of case study that you spend the first bit of the book talking about, and how disruptive smallpox was in the 17th century when the book opens.
Yes, it's absolutely terrifying. You know, it is overwhelmingly, obviously, it's extraordinarily contagious. It runs amok in concentrated urban environments, as it does. And you stand, once you get it, one in every six people who contract it die. So it is absolutely as apocalyptically frightening as you could possibly imagine, really. And I think the point I'd like to make, I don't want to jump your questions, but smallpox is the first, I mean, obviously, bubonic plague had been even more terrifying in the previous century. But bubonic plague had kind of relaxed its talons somewhat in the early 18th century, although there was a very fierce outbreak in Marseille in the early 1720s. So people might have been kind of lulled into a false sense of security, but at the same time that plague was receding, smallpox was arriving. It had been known for a very, very long time, but it became extraordinarily deadly at the end of the 17th, early 18th century. And the great breakthrough about inoculation before Edward Jenner, 100 years later, at the very end of the 18th century, the first time people have to be persuaded, or there's a campaign to be to persuade people to actually put something inside their body that was the very poison that they believed was killing them. It's such a counterintuitive thing to do. We do it all the time now. On the other hand, there are lots and lots of people in the anti-vaccination movement who still believe that that's a kind of insane thing to do, and we're all born with natural immunity and we don't need any help and we're likely to undergo extraordinarily unknown perils if we do. So this sort of moment of benevolent self-poisoning was an astonishing sort of psychological barrier to cross. And it's still absolutely amazing to me that people in such large numbers eventually come to accept that that's the way, not necessarily, you know, at least to escape the certainty of death. Or the likelihood of death, 1 in 6, very bad odds.
What do you think the key factors were in people making that shift to come to accept the fact this was a good thing for them to do?
Well, it helped in Britain in particular. It helped absolutely that the royal family was converted, that there was an extraordinary piece of fortune in that Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who was the wife of the British ambassador to Constantinople, saw that women in Constantinople, and there were reports coming in from other trade and diplomatic British agents all around the Middle East, saw that they were completely unmarked by not only, you know, they'd heard that women actually escaped death, but also, having survived, Lady Wortley Montagu, who'd eloped with her husband Edward, had herself gone through a terrifying attack of smallpox and had survived, but had been a famous beauty and lost all her beauty. Her face was very badly scarred. Her eyelashes never came back. Everybody remarked on that. But she, when she was in Constantinople, Adrianople, when her husband was on a British diplomatic mission there, she noticed that women were absolutely unmarked, and just curiosity led her to believe that inoculation, in other words, taking pus from another smallpox case and injecting it into yourself before you had smallpox, would actually save you, not just from death, but also from the terrible disfigurement that followed. She's a born publicist. She's a really extraordinary woman. And women play a very important part in my book, and they played a very important part in inoculation, because it was thought, well, if a mother is prepared to do this to children, how bad could it possibly be? And she has a lot of important social and literary connections when she comes back to Britain in, I think it was 1717 or 1718. And she converts, most crucially, the Princess of Wales, Princess Caroline of Ansbach. And it was a worry among the royal dynasties. I mean, smallpox was mowing down princes and monarchs and empresses and so on. And so in some sense, the elite really took it on. So Princess Caroline actually has her children inoculated. And because the royal family is doing it, one can easily imagine, you know, what might be the case now. It hits the newspaper press. So you have this convergence of very important posh people accepting what seemed otherwise to be a crazy thing to do, and the press reporting on it, which doesn't mean to say that there wasn't truculent and dug-in opposition, particularly by clerics who thought it was interfering with God's judgment and said so in sermons. But what's really interesting is when you get a little further on, and we're still in the 1720s, there are some extraordinary country doctors. It's not just a matter of a fashion for inoculation. The figure I write about in the book is a man, again, quite well known, called Thomas Nettleton, who lived in Halifax and who who proceeded to inoculate as many people as he possibly could in the whole area around Halifax in Yorkshire. And that, again, things were printed up. The crucial thing was, which again is so struck me as so modern, Matt, that there were you sent all your results to the Royal Society, which collected the data. This great figure called Durin, who ran the publishing side of the Royal Society, James Durin. But then you also had to find a way to get it out to the broader press. And they really campaigned as hard as they could to do that.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you, because obviously your book focuses on a series of remarkable individuals. Are there other wider organisations or, I suppose, cultural forces that you think play a key role in this story that we shouldn't overlook?
Well, we're at a very interesting moment in the 1700s, really, where I don't want to exaggerate the degree in which, you know, suddenly we're in the Age of Enlightenment and science is seen as the new religion, because often the non-religious nature of the 18th century is overdone. I think religion and church is extremely important. If you just think about the rise of intense evangelical religion, dissenters and Methodists and so on, still very, very important. However, it's true to say that when you have the hammer blows of pandemic after pandemic, it does something in your willingness to be kind of passive in the face of divine judgment. So, you know, if there is another kind of faith, you might call it, or belief, and that belief happens to be statistically measurable, or seems to be the case just in terms of people in your neighborhood who are surviving, then you're going to shift some part of your faith to a belief that human ingenuity and human science actually can do what God might seem to be indifferent to or incapable of doing. So we're in a kind of real sort of sea change moment, not yet decided. We're still not decided. You're talking to me and I'm living in a country in the United States where it's part of the kind of orthodoxy of the more, you know, feverish evangelical Christian right that vaccines are a kind of plot. You know, so that battle, which we thought from the 18th century onward, we'd get to a point where it wasn't at all problematic to be a devoted Jew or Christian or Muslim and still have a strong belief in science. We still haven't quite arrived at that point.
Do you think this was also a period in which people gradually came to open their eyes to things happening outside of Europe, taking on cultural and scientific knowledge that was already going on elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, this is another really remarkable thing that I hadn't really expected to find. You know, gradually it became clear. I mean, the first part of the book is called East to West, that a lot of the understanding and confidence, actually, in doing the unthinkable, putting a bit of poison into your body in order to save your children and your own life and save you either from dying or being disfigured, comes from people on the ground as the imperial network of power and knowledge spreads in the Middle East, in Syria and in North Africa and in India. One of the most remarkable documents I talk about is the man who we've learned really to despise and mistrust as the exaggerating doctor chronicler of the black hole of Calcutta, John Zephaniah Holwell, was also extraordinarily interested in traditional Indian medicine and actually writes the first detailed report about how inoculation should be less of a problem in India because in some form or another it had been practiced over the centuries. It's a good deal of natural immunity has arisen in India as a result. But the notion he wrote this book in retirement when he came back from India, in retirement in Pinna, in Middlesex. So I had a very strong image of this sort of mid-18th century doctor who'd been sent out by the rapacious and utterly unscrupulous East India Company in becoming sort of open-minded and rather in love with all kinds of traditional Indian culture, including Ayurvedic and other forms of Indian medicine. So we always think about I know that moment of the dawn of empire being, you know, covered in blood and loot. And that's absolutely true. But it was extraordinarily open as well to understanding new things about the ways in which other cultures had behaved when they were faced with things like epidemics. And there was even, there was a French literature, mostly, about Chinese practice of actually what was called insufflation. In other words, blowing dried pus up your nose, really. It was kind of snorting dried pus, which, you know, doesn't sound like much like fun. And at one point, one doctor, in one case, in England, tries it out with not much luck, I think, really. But it just shows there is a kind of, I don't want to call it a romance exactly, but there is this extraordinary kind of moment where the arrogant Europe is absolutely willing and fascinated by what it can learn from non-European cultures. There were two great sort of enterprises going on. One is imperial loot, really, and the other is conversion. And nearly everybody who reports back to HQ, whether in France or in Scandinavia, indeed, or in Britain, in these two enterprises, also reports back on everything they can find about what we now call kind of manners and mores. So some of the information we have about traditional Chinese medicine comes from Jesuit fathers who are in China and who've made the great find about soft paste Chinese porcelain and actually how possibly you might be able to reproduce that. So they're there in order to win souls, which they don't have much luck. Good luck with that. Number two, to make commercial discoveries, which they have very good luck about, you know, more or less creating a European version of what the Chinese have been doing for centuries. But as they're doing that, they also like to report on everything that has surprised them. So they come with one kind of authority. They deliver it in printed publications. And then often there's an intermediate state where really good writers, and I pick out Voltaire, who was a survivor of a really horrible attack of smallpox, someone who can collate it and deliver it in a kind of language which will get a serious readership.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The next section of your book then explores the spread of cholera in the 19th century. What do we need to understand to make sense of the impact that that disease had on societies in that period?
Well, I think, again, cholera was pretty unknown in Europe until 1817, till very early in the 19th century. So people were not prepared again, and rather like bubonic plague would be, it was extremely swift. If you got it, you died a horrible death. You basically lost all your bodily fluids very, very quickly. And there is this paradox which runs all the way through the book, that everything about progress that made Europe and the West feel buoyant and in control of their lives, the arrival of better highways, above all of the railway train, above all of steamships and steam navigation, everything that was driving Europe into the non-European world and picking up both power and wealth as and when they wanted, was actually creating the ideal conditions for a pathogen to absolutely flourish. In this case, in the case of contaminated water. And it's a very, so it's again, a very, very scary thing. And when, for example, John Snow, the famous British doctor who discovers the single water pump of fecally contaminated, in other words, you know, shit poisoned water in Broad Street just around the corner from my literary agent, as it happens right now. I think it's been successfully cleaned up, I'm glad to say, although I wash my hands very thoroughly every time I go there. It's now called Broadwick Street in the middle of Soho. It was thought, actually, that basically contamination by water, because it was exclusively a kind of waterborne pathogen. If you clean that up, if you created clean water and disinfected everything around once disinfectant was discovered a little bit later on, then that would take care of it. But nobody thought really that travellers, actually, people moving from town to town or country to country in railway trains or carriages, even horse-drawn carriages, could actually invisibly soil some of the upholstery inside a carriage, and next person to use the carriage would be in mortal danger of getting cholera. And railway trains especially, all of which often, you know, had very primitive or no lavatories at all, had commodes, or you had to get off at a station and then get back on again. Nobody really thought that the conditions of economic prosperity and interconnectedness and commercial progress were themselves making the likelihood of the spread of terrifying infectious disease stronger rather than weaker. So that was a battle fought out between people who had different kinds of public health philosophy. It was only when the cholera bacillus was discovered in the 1880s, very late in the 19th century, that people realised actually that the bacillus itself could travel disastrously and speedily and extremely dangerously.
There's a character in this section of the book, Adrien Proust. Can you talk a bit about his work?
Yes, Adrien Proust was Marcel Proust's father. And as someone who's read Proust off and on through my life, Adrien, who was a doctor, and he was also the father of, you know, a famous asthmatic plus hypochondriac as well, has always sort of seemed a ridiculous figure. So he always seemed to me a sort of classic 19th century, heavily bearded, whiskery figure of obtuse authority. But that turns out to be so not the case. And it was when I was reading about these international sanitary conferences, which he didn't find, but he became a great mover and shaker in the belief that you would not actually be able to come to grips with cholera unless you imposed what we would, you know, call a lockdown or a quarantine, actually, serious quarantine between areas that were chronically or endemically vulnerable to cholera, that actually you'd be able to prevent its spread. So he turns out to be a kind of major figure. He shows up at these conferences, which are held periodically every 2 or 3 years. There was one in 1851, but basically they get going seriously with the sanitary conference in Constantinople in a very, very bad year of cholera in 1866. And they go on all the way to 1907. He dies in 1903. But his head is basically teeming with what becomes the idea of for the necessity of some international public health organization. It never quite works out with all the authority that he wants, and in fact nobody agrees that there should be such a place until 1903, which is the year of his death, and then what becomes the kernel of what will turn into the WHO is founded. So he's someone who seemed to me, you know, astonishingly far-sighted in some ways, even if there was an element to his personality that was classically European and imperialist in a way. I mean, his most sort of intense concern was to prevent cholera in particular from coming into Western Europe, actually. So, you know, he has his prophetic and benevolent side and his classically kind of imperialist and defensive and almost neurotic side about creating what would be called a cordon sanitaire against infection from Asia. It was already a kind of issue of tremendous difficulty, is that one particular institution which was dangerous to interrupt, even at times of the most extreme cholera outbreaks, were the pilgrimages to Mecca of the Hajj. Not because he was so myopic or prejudiced that it was because it was a Muslim or an Asian thing, but because the Hajj involved hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people lodging together in very tight quarters on small boats with no sanitary provisions whatsoever. And this was just an absolute paradise for microbial reproduction. There were two huge problems. One was a problem with the British Empire, which was at that very moment in the middle of the 19th century, beginning finally to make a huge amount of money through legal and not so legal means from its Indian Empire. And what the British particularly didn't want to do was stop traffic coming through the Suez Canal. So the British were the last of all to accept the science about the way in which cholera spread and to accept germ theory and kept on saying, no, 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 this is a local matter. If we disinfect local places, this is not really a contagious disease. And there was no need to interrupt the international, imperial, Indian, British trade routes at all. They were constantly fighting that. And the other problem, which the British, but not just the British, had to cope with, was that they were very, you know, the Indian, the uprising, the sepoy uprising of 1857 had a very strong religious element to it. And the British were, quite rightly, very nervous about interrupting the pilgrimage to Mecca. They were worried about it absolutely lighting a tinderbox of insurrection, which could bring down the whole of their imperial presence, not just in India, but in the Near East. So it was always the science always had to somehow be, you know, had to pass political acceptability all the time, as it still does.
I was going to say, do you think that relationship between science and politics is a recurring theme throughout this history?
Yeah, I mean, always, I think, really. One would love to think, actually, that there was a point where, you know, science would be held to be disinterested, that scientific discoveries are thought when they produce inconveniences like lockdowns and the shutting down of trade routes and so on, it would be seen to be for non-ideological purposes. And you can see this kind of forming in these early exercises and these dialogues in the 19th century, where science is somehow held to be, hence the title of my book, an alien thing, that it belongs to international organizations of elite scientists who nobody quite understands what they're doing, and they might possibly have suspicious motives. And, you know, that is a kind of... There is at the heart of this, I have to say, and I guess I don't say this explicitly, really, the kind of sad core of the book is this extraordinary paradox we still find ourselves in now, when we have, you know, two of the very great challenges to the future of humanity are the ecological crisis, the environmental crisis, the sustainability of the planet, and our ability to protect ourselves against great waves of catastrophic pandemics and epidemics. And the paradox I'm talking about is at the same time you want to celebrate and marvel at the sheer extraordinariness of human ingenuity that is present in science and the speed at which that ingenuity can achieve practical results. And on the other hand, the amazing obstinacy or endurance of the most irrational, kind of feverishly prejudiced biases and suspicions about that ingenuity. What the 18th century, you know, enlightened mind thought would happen, that one day knowledge itself would be responsible for eliminating sickness and ignorance and poverty, never really came about, never really, and still has not really come about, because it's up against so much that's actually wired into our shared cultures from one end of the world to the other, that wants to resist it, that wants to see science as some sort of plot.
Skipping ahead to the 19th century, because we should talk about someone who I think is a really pivotal person in this story, and that's Waldemar Hafkin. There are probably people listening to this who have never heard of him. Can you very briefly introduce who he was?
I'm famous for very briefly. Yeah. Not.
Yes.
He was an extraordinary figure. He was a Jew from Odessa who, as a student, was a gun runner trying to protect the Jewish community in Odessa against pogroms. This is just an astonishing discovery, really. Not made by me, but it is absolutely revelatory. Odessa was one of those rare places in Imperial Russia, where Imperial Ukraine and Russia, where Jews were not trapped in the kind of fiddle on the roof world, and they could have a secular education. And he became a student at the new university in Odessa, and he becomes a student of another extraordinary figure called Elie Metchnikoff, who's quite important in the book, who came from a family of converted Jews. And to try and cut a long story short, Havkin is suspected, not altogether incorrectly, of being a kind of armed, seditious, belonging to an armed, seditious student organization. And he goes, he's arrested and imprisoned three times. He's caught with a pistol on him, and he's liberated from prison by his microbiology avant-garde professor, Metchnikoff. So when Metchnikoff goes to the Institut Pasteur in its founding years of 1888, 1889, he brings Vadimar Havkin with him. So Havkin is at the Institut Pasteur as a very, very lowly worm indeed. He can only make ends meet by being an assistant librarian, has to work during nights, but he knows he's in a community that is going to revolutionize everything we know about medicine, about the way the body works, that for the first time is going to make germ theory absolutely clear. There's another great place which Havkin actually visits in Germany, the laboratory of Robert Koch. But the Pasteur Institute is an extraordinary place. And he's given the task, which had seemed to be pretty much impossible, of coming up with a vaccine against cholera. And after a great struggle, he does just that. But cholera at exactly that point is finally receding somewhat from Europe. So Havkin is determined that the only way you'll actually demonstrate to the public the acceptability of a cholera vaccine, of actually putting cholera into your body, mind smallpox, in order to protect yourself from mortal peril, is if you can do controlled experiments, if you can have an identical population, half of whom get inoculated and half of whom don't get inoculated. And the only place you can do that is in Asia. So astonishingly, it so happens that the British ambassador in Paris, we're now in around 1890, is a man called the Marquis of Dufferin, who'd been Viceroy of India. And he is also extraordinarily interested in this possibility of inoculation against cholera, and gives Havkin his first opportunity to work in India. The only problem is, as he realizes very quickly when he gets to India, is that the Indian medical service do not want to know about that. They are completely, partly they're dominated by, you know, the correct assumption that you have to disinfect contaminated and polluted water. But they're not interested in learning about microbiology, about germ theory, about what the so-called comma bacillus, about, you know, looking down microscopes and actually understanding the deep science of actually how these organisms live and reproduce and multiply, and how disease can actually be contained. So he has no support whatsoever, or very, very marginal support. A letter is sent out to various regions around Bengal saying, you might be able to give this man some assistance, but he has really no funds. He's in luck in that someone else who was at the Institut Pasteur with him, a man called Ernest Hankin, has been put in charge of a biological and medical station in Agra. So with Agra, Havkin has some support. But what is so extraordinary about Havkin in this period, and indeed through his whole life, is that he's, in the first instance, the empire is only interested in inoculating Europeans who are in India, British people in India, and native troops. Havkin is interested in going to the poorest of the poor. He begins by inoculating people in Calcutta slums, in the middle of Calcutta and on the outskirts of Calcutta. And he takes he trains Indian doctors in inoculation, in why they should be doing it and how to do it. And this is an untold chapter in imperial history. And when we, you know, when we think about the kind of all the sins of empire, really, when we think about it as a good and bad, black and white kind of story, this is a kind of an extraordinary moment, I think, actually, where someone from such an improbable background, gun-running Russian Jew out of a laboratory in Paris, comes to India. And he's always the people who Hafkeen calls, he's a prolific writer of diaries, the gentleman. He talks about the gentleman rather sardonically. They continue to think that he's very suspicious and eccentric and unhelpful and possibly harmful. And it doesn't help that, of course, his origins are Russian. And that's the time of the great game, and this neurotic fear that the Russian army is going to pour down the Khyber Pass and they're your major enemy in India. So at some point, he's actually thought of as a spy and is actually called that. But he goes on, he becomes very famous and, I mean, extraordinarily famous back in Britain. People like Joseph Lister, who was responsible for, of course, you know, discovering how antiseptic material can stop people from dying of sepsis, of exposed wounds in hospitals and other places too, and on the battlefield. People like Lister really adopt Hafkeen as a kind of hero, and he's celebrated and lauded back in England. But then whenever he goes back to India, he meets with profound suspicion and hostility, really. So he has to battle his way through. Nonetheless, rather extraordinarily, in 1899, he is the head of a facility in Mumbai, then, of course, called Bombay, which is the first mass production line of vaccines against bubonic plague. Bubonic plague comes back in a major way, kills millions upon millions of people in India and China. And Hafkeen is the one who has actually a production line going, which produces tens of thousands of doses per day, which are, again, sent out into all the regions of India. And it's an extraordinary thing to see. There are these wonderful... Have you seen the photographs? I don't know if you saw those. Oh, okay, in the finished book, there are extraordinary photographs out of this place, a sort of production facility in Bombay, with thousands of incubation bottles waiting to be dispatched, and the people who are labelling them and sending them out and working on. And we're talking about, you know, 1899, 1900, 1901, and saving people from the horrors of a renewal of bubonic plague. And then a terrible disaster happens to him.
Yes, how much do you want to talk about that? Because that's an extraordinary, quite upsetting period in his life, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a tragic catastrophe. Even as a huge outbreak of bubonic plague occurs all over India in the wake of a serious moment of famine, plague comes to Bombay and Calcutta and Karachi and places on the west coast, but also in Bengal in 1896, in a very, very serious way indeed. Ends up killing millions of people. 12 million people die in Asia of bubonic plague between the middle of the 1890s and the early 1920s. So it is really a kind of monstrous return of the Black Death, which we've all forgotten about or very rarely gets a mention in world histories because it's not happening in Europe. And what happens, Hafkeen is turning out 80, 100,000 doses per day. So 2 million doses. And he's working with just, you know, we think of Pfizer and Moderna having all the manufacturers and AstraZeneca. Who knows how many people are actually producing the necessary doses here. He starts out with just 53 people working in Bombay. It goes up to 200, but that's still a kind of tiny group of people turning out these millions of doses. It's just an absolute miracle being sent to Africa as well as India. So in 1902, in a tiny village called Mulkawal in Punjab. 19 people die of tetanus poisoning as a result of one contaminated batch of plague vaccine. And it's later discovered, but it takes a long campaign of vindication, that actually the contamination had happened in the village, not at the producing facility in Mumbai, when someone had dropped a rubber stopper on the ground. These inoculations in rural districts always happened in the open air, in fields, and had actually picked up the stopper and just swished it in carbolic lotion rather than passed it through the heat sterilization that Hafkin had insisted was the absolutely crucial way in which you rendered anything that might have been become dirty safe. He gets the blame immediately. A commission of inquiry is set up. He's suspended and then he's fired and is in utter disgrace. Comes back, tries to kind of plead his case, gives lectures in Paris, writes to the great and the good, to really no avail, until another extraordinary figure, who also regards himself as a kind of fellow outsider in a way, even though he'd come through an imperial family, a man called Ronald Ross, who was the man who identified the connection between Anopheles mosquitoes and malaria, knows in his heart of heart that some terrible injustice has been done to Hafkin, and runs a campaign. It's like a kind of medical Dreyfus affair, really. And in the end, it takes till 1907 for Hafkin to be fully vindicated and given a kind of job back. But he's not, he's kept still kept away from vaccine production. He himself does not really feel properly vindicated. And the truth is that his career and his life was broken by this one particular incident. So it is heartrending. And the then Viceroy of India, Lord Curzon, is just, you know, beside himself with rage at what he thinks Hafkin has done to the credibility of the British Empire. The British Empire wants to identify itself as tough and strict and paternalistic, but interested in the health and physical welfare of its millions of Indian subjects. And what Curzon says is that the disaster for which he holds Hafkin responsible basically undermines the credibility of British boasts to be really benevolently concerned. So he says he should be put on trial and hanged for what he's done to us, really. It's an awful thing to say. And there is, of course, never exactly explicit, but there's a strong whiff of anti-Semitism in all this. There's no doubt about it at all. So they're eager to find someone or something. The someone is Hafkin. The something is the new science of microbiology, which had rashly and irresponsibly replaced the kind of cult of disinfection. I mean, the one thing that we haven't talked about, Matt, is that because cholera was so much constantly on their minds, when something with a completely different, pathogenic structure comes along, like bubonic plague, which has nothing to do with contaminated water, but everything to do with microorganisms living on fleas, which are lodged on rats and then which go on to bite humans. So a completely different sort of mindset was needed to figure out what it was and how to deal with it. The policy of disinfection was to track down anybody suspected of showing the symptoms of bubonic plague and tear down their house and separate families. And children were taken from parents, husbands were taken from wives. People were inspected, the poor, when they got off railway trains. Furniture was burnt, clothing was burnt. These are often kind of, you know, modest heirlooms in impoverished families. And when Hafkin starts to say, as he does around the end of the 1890s, none of this is doing good. When you burn down a house or you destroy a house, guess what? The rats are going to leave and the fleas are going to leave on the rats. And the fleas are the reservoirs of these microorganisms that you're actually spreading plague rather than getting rid of it. They do not want to listen. And he's regarded as, someone committing a heresy against what is supposed to be known about the way in which you contain infectious disease.
How would you like your book to change our view of our own pandemic moment, I suppose, and our relationship with the world around us?
Well, the book is, as you know, it's... celebration isn't quite the right word. It's a passionate statement on behalf of science, really. I would like it to be seen, you know, I talked earlier on about this paradox in which we're trapped. On the one hand, humans are a marvel of ingenuity, astonishing resourcefulness, and at the same time, a great kind of pond of primitive terror and paranoia and superstition. So the book is a vote, a plea, a persuasion campaign to embrace science, not uncritically, but scientists are the first to be vigilant about problems in their own procedure. But, you know, I would love it to be an antidote to the mistrust and suspicion and sense in which really scientists are involved in some sort of scheme that only they they have an interest in, really. So if it even moves the dial a tiny bit through storytelling is the only way I know how to do it, then that will make an old geezer marginally happy.
That was Simon Sharma. Foreign Bodies, Pandemics, Vaccines and the Health of Nations is out now, published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.